Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time now for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show with lots of good people involved, lots of voices around the table, so to speak. And the host of the program, its founder and guiding light, is Carol Marx. Carol Marx is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and she's a champion in the battle against ageism. Let's kick the program off right now with Carol Marx in a provocative and candid interview speaking with Laura Bond. Laura Bond is a freelance journalist and certified holistic health coach, and she's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled You Can Say No to Chemo, published by Canary Press.
The book grew out of a blog, and we're going to get started by talking about how all that happened and the interesting information in the book. So Laura Bond, the warmest of welcomes to A Touch of Gray.
Thank you. Well, it's interesting you say, you know, how it all got started, because when my mom was diagnosed with ovarian and uterine cancer back in 2011 now, people were constantly saying that they just assumed that she was going to have chemo when they heard the terrible news. And as her daughter, you know, I'd flown back from London to be with her in Australia, and I felt like I spent that whole first week saying, no, mum's not having chemo. And people were just floored. They just didn't understand it. They didn't get it. And so part of the reason I decided to write the blog, which then turned into the book, was because I wanted to open people's minds up to the wide range of healing possibilities out there, and also to talk about some of the reasons, to explain why mum decided not to do chemotherapy in the first place.
I think before we go on, though, we do need to make the important point to say that your book was definitely also not written to say to people you must not have chemo, but you had a very important purpose, and that was instead to open people's minds to other alternative treatments for cancer, either on their own or along with what they decide to do, if it was the traditional therapies of chemotherapy and radiation, that they could also use some of these alternative treatments.
Absolutely. I'm definitely not telling people what to do, and thank you so much, Carol, for making that distinction, because it's an important one. Even in my book, I actually talk about ways that you can avoid losing your hair if you are having chemotherapy. So that there are fantastic things now, things like hypothermia, which is available in Germany, and increasingly all over the world at different places like Japan. And what that does is it uses heat treatment to be able to target where the chemotherapy will go, so that they can use much, much smaller doses, which means that the people don't have to suffer the horrifying side effects of chemotherapy, like losing their hair, like vomiting. Instead, through the hypothermia, it's able to target the chemotherapy drug in a much better way to the area it needs to go, so that you don't have your whole system, your whole body ravaged unnecessarily.
Well, one thing that I really learned from your book that I hadn't realized when it comes to chemo and radiation, I know they've helped many patients because they do have this ability to shrink tumors, but also they're not able to attack some important cancer cells. And what are their limitations in doing that? And why is the ability not to be able to target stem cells so important?
Yes, yeah, so, but people. First of all, let's talk about cancer stem cells, because I think a lot of people might not have heard about them. So cancer stem cells are the germ cells from which new tumors arrive. And what the latest research is showing us, and this is from Harvard Medical School and UCLA, the top research universities in America, what they've recently discovered is that both radiotherapy and chemotherapy, new evidence suggests that they actually stimulate cancer stem cells, which causes cancer to come back. And I mean, this isn't fringe conspiracy. This was covered by Fox News.
That's amazing news, and I'm sure that my listeners haven't heard about it. I hadn't. And I was very, you know, also interested in the fact that you point out a number of times in the book that cancer is not a one-size-fits-all disease, but there are certain steps that can help both every cancer patient gain a foothold on recovery and help those of us that are currently well keep up our good health. And you talk about something I hadn't thought about, and that was that sugar is cancer's favorite food. And I know sugar isn't good, but I never thought it was that bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's public enemy number one at the moment. I know over here in the UK and in America, you know, it's linked to everything now, from Alzheimer's and acne to cancer. And with cancer, it's very obvious, because there are 4 receptor sites for sugar on a normal healthy cell, and there are 96 receptor sites, 96 on a cancer cell. So cancer cells are basically sugar-guzzling machines. So the number one thing anyone should do, whatever cancer they have, if they're first diagnosed with cancer, is to cut down on sugar. It's such a simple but very profound step you can take on the path to recovery. But I've been doing a lot of workshops on prevention, because I think that's really where we need to focus our attention, considering 1 in 2 people will now be diagnosed with cancer in their lifetime. And for people, in order to stay healthy, you want to keep the body, you want to, cut sugar out of your diet, you want to stay oxygenated, and you want to stay alkaline. So drinking things like green vegetable juice, which has become very popular, for good reason.
And I guess a good reason for drinking the green vegetable juice, I understand your mom does it every morning, is the chlorophyll in the juice is what helps.
Yes, exactly. So we know that chlorophyll increases oxygen transport throughout the cells. So it's helping, it builds hemoglobin, and it helps boost oxygen in the cells. And we know that cancer hates a highly oxygenated body. So drinking a juice with things like wheatgrass especially, it's one of the most potent purifiers known to man. With wheatgrass, celery, throw in a carrot for a bit of sweetness, kale, all these beautiful green leafy greens will really help oxygenate the body. I mean, we know that a wheatgrass shot, for example, 125 ml shot is worth 1 kilo of leafy vegetables.
Wow, and you do talk a lot about having injections of a lot of vitamin C, injected 3 times a week. I guess it's, 60,000 milligrams. Now, have studies been shown that at that level, vitamin C can kill cancer cells but leave the healthy cells still intact?
Yes, and it's exciting research from Mark Levine that came out in 2008, and he was from the America's National Institutes of Health. And he did a study showing that at those levels, past 50,000 milligrams, that the vitamin C turns into a pro-oxidant and that it is able to kill cancer cells and leave healthy cells intact. And that's the important point. I mean, all these things, there's not one thing that will work for everyone. So vitamin C therapy, which is talking about injecting vitamin C at very high doses, it works very well for some people. It can, really help some people heal. For others, it's there are other things that are going to be better for them. Maybe it's ozone, maybe it's hypothermia, maybe it's, having infrared saunas. So everyone has to work out what works for them, because everyone is so individual. But the thing that's great about all these alternative treatments is that they're not going to harm your body. All that they're going to do is build up your immune system. Whether you leave after 6 months cancer-free or not, you're not going to leave with the body completely ravaged, and poisoned, which you've got to, there's something to be said for that.
Right, a lot. And now, if you decide that chemo is your choice, there are alternative and inexpensive ways that have no side effects to support your treatment. And you mentioned, too, bicarbonate of soda and turmeric, which is a spice. Can you tell us briefly about them, and what are the benefits?
Right. So with turmeric, it's been known as a healing powerhouse for thousands of years. And the great thing is modern science is now validating all these beliefs, this sort of folklore that we had around turmeric. So it's been renowned in India in Ayurvedic traditions for thousands of years to help, lower inflammation, to heal the body. It's even great for gynecological issues, actually. But we now know from lab studies that it can kill cancer cells. And there's a professor at MD Anderson Cancer Center, Professor Bharat Agarwal. And when I interviewed him, he was one of 60 experts I interviewed. He told me that there is not one cancer, at least in the test tube, that turmeric cannot stop. Or curcumin, rather, which is the active ingredient in turmeric. So, I think it's just one of the best things everyone should do, regardless of whether they have cancer or not. It's one of the best preventative measures you can take is to include turmeric in your diet. So, I juice it every morning. I buy organic turmeric from my local Planet Organic, which is an organic supermarket, and I put turmeric in with celery, with carrot, with broccoli sprouts. And it's interesting, when you get it fresh, it has a really lovely mellow flavor.
Oh, wow. And then you also talk about that bicarbonate of soda is helpful because it balances your pH level. And I guess you can use that in a variety of ways, too.
Exactly. Everyone's different, and I'm certainly not prescribing or advising anyone personally, but from the research I did and experts I interviewed, it was sort of, you know, a half a teaspoon, you don't need much, mixed in water, and it's one of the quickest ways to alkalize the body, according to Mark Serkis, who I interviewed in sort of Chapter 13, which is defeating cancer on the cheap. You want to make sure when you get the bicarb soda, though, that it's aluminium-free. So there's a great brand in America called Bob's Red Mill, which I'd recommend to people because it doesn't have any of the, as you say, aluminum, I think, rather than aluminium.
That's Laura Bond in conversation with Carol Marks. The book is titled You Can Say No to Chemo, published by Canary Press. For more information, go to laurabond.com. I'm Michael Harrison. Carol Marks returns with another very interesting and informative interview next when A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. New guidelines from the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism for persons 65 and older reveal that if women drink more than 7 drinks per week or greater than 3 drinks per occasion, and men 14 drinks per week or greater than 4 drinks per occasion, you're at risk for illness or injury. As the body ages, the tolerance to alcoholic beverages decreases. Literally, at 65 and older, you're unable to process alcoholic beverages as, say, a person that is 45. Alcoholic overuse and intolerance can worsen mental confusion, problems with balance and falls, depressive disorders, dehydration, inadequate nutrition, adverse interaction with some medications, and can lead to social isolation. One drink is 12 ounces of beer, 5 ounces of wine, or 1.5 ounces of liquor, or the amount in a shot glass. Are you ready to acknowledge that at age 65 and older, that fewer than 7 drinks per week or 1 drink per day is the limit and offers you the advantages of leading a healthier and safer lifestyle? I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of our program, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Stephen Hess. Stephen Hess is one of the foremost authorities on media and government in the U.S. He's a senior fellow emeritus in governance at the Brookings Institution. And he's going to talk to Carol about his new book, which sheds a lot of light on very interesting, recent, but not that recent, history. It's titled The Professor and the President, Daniel Patrick Moynihan in the Nixon White House. It's published by Brookings Institution Press.
Now, for those who don't know much about Patrick Moynihan, what made him such a striking person in the way he looked, acted, and thought?
Well, the looks, I wish we were on television and you'd see that in an instant. He was 6'5", had a way of just moving and walking and talking that was quite uniquely his own. I described a friend of his saying that he always walked down the street as if he were going to a circus. He was a great wit. He was a very funny guy, and in the book he uses that wit for very good political reasons. So then a funny thing, a book that takes place in the East Wing of the White House, a book that's about policy making, is really very funny.
It is. And now let's get to the story of the most unlikely political partnership and how it came about. And you write that in 1969 Nixon needed a Democrat. Why was that, and why did Patrick Moynihan want to hook up with the president?
Yeah, well, the book is a series of interrelated mysteries. The first mystery is the one you've just suggested. Why would Nixon, the conservative Republican, choose Moynihan, the liberal professor from Harvard, for Nixon? It would appear obvious on one level. That is, he had just won a very, very close election, one of the closest elections in history. And secondly, he was the first president since Zachary Taylor in 1849 who came into the White House with both parties, both the chambers of Congress, in the opposition party. So it made sense to bring a Democrat or some Democrat, the opposition party into his administration, a bipartisan move. What most presidents do, this is standard fare, most presidents do is put somebody in the cabinet. That's easy to do, because if you don't get on, you just fire them. What Nixon did was to put Moynihan in the White House as his principal advisor. Now, this is very high risk, and why he did it is part of that story. For Moynihan, it's not a political risk. It's really sort of a psychological risk. Nixon was a person who really was held almost in contempt in the world that Moynihan were in, that is Cambridge, Massachusetts, and the west side of Manhattan in New York. So to go with him is, in a sense, going with the enemy. But nevertheless, when a president asks you to do something and what he asks you to do is important, if you're a patriot, you do it.
And President Nixon went on to have Patrick Moynihan become part of the executive branch, and he was the head of the Urban Affairs Council. And I guess that was, and I hadn't realized how little interest Nixon did have in domestic issues. I knew he was interested in foreign affairs, but I didn't realize he had no interest in what was going on in a lot of things in this country.
Yeah, I think that was really what gave Pat Moynihan, he was called the running room that he needed to educate the president. He was a professor, and he was there, he thought, to educate the president. The fact is that the president, strangely, had spent all his life just overwhelmingly involved and caring about international relations. And oddly enough, for a man who had quested for the presidency for 20 years, he really didn't have strong views or knowledge of American domestic policy. So for Moynihan, it was a great opportunity to educate. He started this almost from day one. He sent the president these long, convoluted, complicated literary essays about things that interested him, which are not the things that presidents usually get. I was in the White House once before under Eisenhower, so I know the sort of memos presidents typically get. But what he was doing was he was addressing Nixon intellectual to intellectual. And Nixon had never been addressed that way before, and he loved it. And that was really, in a strange way, the beginning of a friendship in which neither man had known the other until the appointment. In fact, the very first lines of the book are that I'm the only person, perhaps in history, who was a friend of Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Richard Milhouse Nixon before they knew each other. So it was very unusual to pick somebody who was a complete unknown. In fact, one of people in the campaign, an assistant to me who had gone to Harvard, asked the president-elect, Nixon, is he called Daniel or Dan? Well, everybody who knew him knew that he was called Patrick. He wasn't called Daniel or Dan. So that's how far away the two people were when they started. So it really was about the oddest couple you could get in public affairs.
But President Nixon really enjoyed the time that he spent with Pat Moynihan. And what was it about him that he so enjoyed being with him?
Well, several things. This was a rather gray White House. It was, and Pat was quite the opposite. He was just bubbling over with energy and ideas and so forth. So the contrast was quite marked. And Nixon, who really liked to be alone, and moved his office out of the Oval Office, which he made ceremonial, across the street to the Executive Office Building, where he just wanted to think things through. And so he ultimately would invite Pat Moynihan over, and they would have long conversations. The president would say, "Pat, what book should I read?" And in fact, there's a chapter in my book that tells exactly the books that Moynihan recommended to the president. And what happened? The president had a habit of waking up at 2 or 3 in the morning, and he started to read these books. And in some ways, they actually did change his life. So it was a unique friendship.
And do you think that Pat Moynihan was surprised to find out how smart President Nixon really was?
I don't know any reason to think he would. I mean, he opposed him politically, but he didn't think that he was a dullard. In fact, Nixon was incredibly smart. And if you're a professor, you love to have a student who's incredibly smart. So on that level, they got on quite well.
Now, the thing I found very difficult to understand was how Pat Moynihan got President Nixon to endorse a welfare reform that had a family assistance plan in which there would be an allowance for the poor, even though the president had voiced in his campaign great opposition to welfare reform.
Yeah.
So why do you think President Nixon went along with this?
Well, that's the ultimate mystery that I present in the book. And the answer in part is that both Moynihan and Nixon were poor boys. They had different experiences, very different experiences, poor boy. In Pat's case, his father left him when he was young. He never saw his father again. In Nixon's case, his father had a little store. And as he would later explain in an important speech, he would watch the poor people, including poor boys who he were in his class at school, come in and they were on welfare and they needed things. And it wasn't just that they didn't have money, because the Nixons themselves didn't have much money, but they were never, according to Nixon, they would never be looked upon in the same way again. There was always that question of dependency. And as Nixon went through the domestic agenda, if you will, the one issue that he kept coming back to, the one issue he kept asking for more and more information, was welfare. And he was willing to take a chance on this. And Pat offered him a plan in which he could prove that it was going to work, because there had never been this experience before. But Nixon was willing to gamble because he was so convinced that the welfare system we had was not working.
That's Stephen Hess in conversation with Carol Marx. His book is titled The Professor and the President, Daniel Patrick Moynihan in the Nixon White House, published by Brookings Institution Press. Coming up next, we're going to be joined by Kevin Casey of Talkers Magazine. We're going to talk a little bit about what's going on behind the scenes in talk media. And then Steve Wiseman joins us to give you information to protect yourself against fraud and other important stuff right here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues. Time now for a very special little feature here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. There's an album out by a group that was very popular back in the 70s. They had a hit called Back When My Hair Was Short. It was a top 40 hit on all the major trades. And then the years went by, and they went on to other things. And just recently, they went back in the studio and recorded an album called Every 40 Years, 40 Years Later. And there's a song on it that's perfect for this program. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Gun Hill Road with Everything Passes.
Sometimes I think I'm alone. I think I'm the only one who's ever gotten old. But I should have known that it's the same sob story I was always told. But just like everybody else, I didn't listen when they whined. I had to find out for myself. You lose your body and your mind. Oh, everything passes. And now I need glasses. Oh, I can't see far, though I've traveled far and wide. I'm still a boy inside.
All the news cannot be bad. Oh,
Gun Hill Road with Everything Passes from their new album Every 40 Years. Want to know more? Go to GunHillRoadMusic.com. That's GunHillRoadMusic.com. Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. This is the point in the program where we're joined by our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey. Kevin Casey is also the vice president and executive editor of the trade magazine, Talkers. Talkers serves the talk radio industry as, I mentioned, a trade publication, which means people in the business read it to find out about their business. And Kevin, this has been a week marked by the passing of one of the legends of radio. I guess he's so big a legend and such a giant and beloved figure in our business that we published the news of his passing in both Talkers and Radio Info, which means he was of interest to people in the talk business and the music radio business. I'm talking about Gary Owens. Your thoughts?
Yeah, Gary Owens was a legend, and growing up for me in the Midwest, I only knew him from Laugh-In as a young person. It was years later, as I became a radio guy, that I finally learned about all of his actual work in radio instead of the guy pretending to be on the radio by holding his ear on Laugh-In. But he was an outstanding talent and a guy who worked for years in markets like Los Angeles. Well, he started out in the Midwest in Nebraska, but he was a huge force in Los Angeles radio from the early 60s all the way through, I think, 1981 when he finally stepped down from KMPC.
Yeah, KMPC was in its day a big, we used to call it MOR in the business, middle of the road.
Mm-hmm.
And it really was the precursor to what today is called adult contemporary. Back in those days, there was a big gulf between what adults listened to and what kids listened to. The baby boomers had a very distinctly different style of music than the parents. And the DJs on the MOR stations, the adult stations, were really quite interesting characters. There's a whole school of them, and they're mostly gone. And now another one is gone, Gary Owens passing away at the age of 80. I had the great fortune of knowing him, meeting him, and even working with him. He was the kind of a guy that would show up at events and MC them for you, or lend his smooth elegance to them. And he opened up an MC to show that I put on. I produced a TV show back in the early 80s at a nightclub in Hollywood, featuring a reunion between the legendary ventriloquist Paul Winchell and his dummies Jerry Mahoney and Knucklehead Smith. I don't know if you remember them, but they were very big when I was a kid. And Winchell had gone on to other things, and I talked him into getting back into it. And we had star-studded audience, and Gary Owens emceed it for us. He introduced it, and just having him there when the curtain opened, so to speak, and there's Gary Owens, it's like Michael Buffer opening up a boxing match. You know it's a big one. So I certainly appreciate your bringing this up. And another example of the great golden age of radio passing into history.
Yeah.
Well, tell you, hopefully there'll be new golden ages and plenty of history yet to be written in this wonderful medium known as radio. Kevin, thank you for joining us. Kevin Casey is the executive editor. He is the vice president and executive editor of Talkers. If you're interested in what's going on behind the scenes in the talk radio business, it's all there at talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison. More Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, coming up in just a moment.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. 1 in 3 American senior citizens injures themselves in a fall every year. That means that nearly all of the country's senior population is at risk of a life-changing injury that may result in a loss of independence and a long period of rehabilitation or even death. The most common injuries related to falls are head trauma and hip fractures, according to the Centers for Disease Control. So how can you prevent such an event? Have a home safety evaluation from a licensed physical therapist, routine visits to your medical doctor, exercise 3 times a week for strength and balance training, semi-annual eye exams, and a monthly review of your medications by a doctor or pharmacist. Every time you walk out the door or even get out of bed in the morning, you run the risk of injuring yourself by a fall. Taking these preventative measures, you do minimize these chances. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at premiergeriatricrn.com.
Whoa, a new digital music player. Thanks, Mom.
Oh, I'm glad you like it, because I can't wait to toss the big stereo. And now that we got your dad that big HD TV he wanted, we can throw out our old TV, too.
Hold up. You can't just throw out electronics.
Really?
They need to be recycled or donated.
And how would we do that?
It's so easy, Mom. Today, recycling electronics is just as easy as buying them. GreenerGadgets.org has all the info. We just enter our zip code to find a certified recycling center nearby. There are thousands of them, and new ones are being added all the time. Some of our local stores are even certified recycling locations.
I like that.
Did you know that some of the stuff in our old electronics could be used to make new products and conserve natural resources?
Well, okay then. Let's gather them up. What was that website again?
GreenerGadgets.org. We just enter our zip code and go.
My golden retriever, Sundance, is a lot more playful now. She has more pep and energy than I've seen in years.
Tons of energy. Petey is having fun again. He's got a shiny coat and a good, healthy weight.
Molly's been having 4 scoops a day. She pushes her little bowl all the way across the room, emptying every last single crumb. She has slimmed down and gotten this puppy look.
She's got life. She's got energy. She's got stuff to give.
We get asked all the time when we're at shows, how do you get your dog so healthy and shiny and glossy?
DinoVite.com.
859-428-1000.
The omega-3 fatty acids.
Flaxseed, zinc, alfalfa.
The digestive enzymes that are cooked out of regular dog food.
Family will be on Dynavite for the rest of his life.
Just feed your dog right. Use Dynavite. If it's working, don't quit.
859-428-1000.
859-428-1000.
DinoVite.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and now for the rest of the way, we're being joined by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman, in conversation now with Dr. Angelo Volandes. He's a physician and a researcher at Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, and he's going to tell Steve about his new book titled, The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. It's published by Bloomsbury.
Dr. Volandes, we have a medical establishment that can prolong existence. I'm not even going to say life, but what is the cost of prolonging existence?
It's great to be here. So what's the cost of prolonging existence? I guess on the simple level, you could say it's expensive. But I'm really not concerned about the expense as much as the cost in terms of the toll, the human toll and suffering that happens when a healthcare system and doctors don't honor and respect patients' preferences. And that's really what the book's about. It's what happens when we don't stop, listen to our patients, and have a conversation about what's important to them when they're facing a critical illness.
And actually, that's I was asking not just as a financial, but really even more, like you say, the emotional toll. I mean, one of the things that strikes me is it does seem that too often, perhaps the physicians themselves, are they taught in medical school how to communicate what the options are and the toll that that can take to their patients?
Unfortunately, many of our medical schools don't prioritize having the conversation. You know, and it occurs at many levels. Before a medical student even comes to the medical school, when we're picking students through applications, none of us ever stop and say, well, are they good communicators? Will they be good people to talk to about end-of-life care? So from the get-go, from the beginning, when we're selecting people to come into medical school, we don't even think about this. And then throughout medical school and later as young doctors in residency, we don't prioritize having the conversation or how to speak to our patients and families. And that's because there's so much to learn within medicine. But I think that's really short-sighted, because if we don't focus on how to train our future doctors on how to talk to patients, how to have that dialogue, how to talk about prognosis, well, then it's going to lead to the problems that we see in healthcare today, namely people, families, getting medical care in our hospitals and healthcare systems that if they were more informed about, they truly would not want.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that about those characteristics, because two of my good friends from college, one of them, my college roommate, Dr. Stephen Parnell, actually taught at Harvard Medical School for a period, and he is a practicing physician and one of the most empathetic, communicative people. You just feel better in his presence, and he does work closely with patients. We had another friend who was a terrific person, but a horrible communicator with no people skills, and he actually did go into, he recognized that and went into research. But how about, when is the best time for patients to be educated about terminal care?
Sure. Well, let me tell you when the worst time is. The worst time is when you're critically ill, you're in the emergency room, when you're being admitted to the hospital, and then you see your doctor in the hospital for the first time, and you start the conversation at that point. I think we can all agree that that's the worst time to have this conversation. I like to tell my patients it's a great time to have the conversation as early upstream as possible, when you're feeling great, when you don't have a critical illness, when you're not feeling sick, when you can have some time to really think about those questions. What's important to you? What brings happiness and joy in your life? What are your fears? What are your hopes about medical care? And I think that gives you the opportunity, the patient and also the family, to really think about this and to start a conversation before you ever set foot into the hospital. And I don't think this is just for doctors and patients. I think this should be occurring when we talk to our loved ones. When I talk to my dad, when I talk to my kids, I think it's important that all of us routinely have this conversation, because it's not just about end of life. It's not just about death. It's about life. It's about living well for as long as you can. And I think it's important that all of us realize this should be the new normal. This is what it means to be a patient in a healthcare system, is to talk about these sort of things when you're feeling great. So that when you do feel critically ill, when you are in that hospital, or when you're facing a serious life-limiting illness, it's not the first time you're having this conversation, but it's something that you've thought about for years.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more, and I think this is also something that I'm an elder law attorney and deal with healthcare proxies a lot, and we do talk about to some extent and advise our clients, talk with your physician about what kind of care you would want in a critical situation. But I think we need to initiate this more and push this more, because like you said, it's almost like in our society we deny death. It's not going to happen, so if we don't talk about it, it won't happen, although I will bring a change of underwear. But the thing is that we should be talking about, like you said, the emphasis on what kind of a life do we wish to lead. Now, how about your book? It just, well, first of all, it opened my eyes, because I didn't realize how truly invasive so many of the things that can be done medically to preserve someone's existence, even if you've got a fragile person and you're doing CPR, you can be breaking ribs. I mean, it was eye-opening to me. So what do we use for protocol? Where do we introduce your conversation?
Well, I think we introduce the conversation in all aspects of our lives, that it's not just in the hospitals, it's not just in healthcare clinics, but anytime you have an interaction with a medical issue, we should be having these conversations. And when you talk about the interventions, you know, part of the inspiration for writing the book is because I really felt that what I was doing as an individual doctor was wrong, was I was performing these procedures on patients that I honestly would never perform on my dad or on myself. And so I'm hoping that once people read the book and understand what can potentially go wrong through these stories of seven patients that I personally took care of, that they understand this is what can happen if you're not going to have the conversation, because the lives of those seven patients hinged on whether or not they had a conversation with their doctor or some healthcare provider.
And, you know, one of the things that you do so well is, first of all, the book is so wonderfully readable, but it's human, it's life-affirming. And in the stories of these people, you get to feel a part of what they went through, and it becomes so much more real than talking about it in the abstract. And then you also talk in the book about the kinds of questions that you do want to ask and take part of, as you say, with the family. So this is something that I guess we really need to introduce, as you say, earlier into the conversation. Now, tell us about the work of your nonprofit, the Advanced Care Planning Decisions. What do you do with that?
Our nonprofit is really focused on making sure that patients and families are empowered. Because we realize as a healthcare system, patients are not at the center of care. So the nonprofit's mission is to educate people, and we feel that a great way to educate people and empower them about their options is to use video technology. And I talk a lot about that in the book, about, you know, if your doctor's not going to have this conversation, well, you can empower yourself to know your options through a video. And part of the book is a video at theconversationbook.org, where people can learn their options and start the conversation on their own. So our nonprofit leverages the power of video to help empower patients and families to get the right care at the right time and on their terms.
That's Dr. Angelo Valandis in conversation with our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. His book is titled The Conversation, A Revolutionary Plan for End-of-Life Care. It's published by Bloomsbury. I'm Michael Harrison. Steve Wiseman returns for the final segment of our program this hour to talk about TurboTax and income tax identity theft. That's next on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps, so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
She's conquered some of the most challenging ski courses anywhere, but with only one leg, the odds were against her even walking.
the growth was stunted in my right leg when I was born, and the doctors told my mother we needed to amputate when I was 5 years old.
Bonnie was helped at a Shriners Hospital, one of a network of 22 hospitals helping kids throughout North America. Shriners Hospitals provide world-class orthopedic and burn medical care, and they offer that care totally free of charge.
The care and treatment the Shriners gave me was a gift. It wasn't just about learning to walk. They helped me to believe in myself.
There's a Shriners Hospital helping kids from this area realize their dreams.
If I went back to the Shriners Hospital and talked to the nurses and doctors, I would say thank you. Thank you for making my dreams come true.
If you know a child they could help, call 1-800-237-5055. Shriners, giving help and hope to kids for over 80 years.
For Touch of Gray in Washington, D.C., I'm Suzanne Hannis. It is important to address a personal emergency response system in your home in case of falls or injuries. AARP encourages their use for many older Americans to enhance independence and security, especially for those living alone. Many brands of PERS are available on the market, and seniors should consider their specific needs and budget before deciding on a system. The Federal Trade Commission provides free online information. One can get a system as basic as wearing a necklace or bracelet and push a button that will transmit to an installed response center through your landline telephone. In the event of an emergency with falls, chest pain, a suspected intruder, a press of the button will have a 911 ambulance dispatched to your home, even if you cannot reach your phone. PERS systems can be rented or purchased through local hospitals and are affordable and serviced by representatives. I'm Suzanne Hannis. Find out more at PremierGeriatricRN.com.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And we're joined again by our senior correspondent, Steve Wiseman. Steve is a prolific author. He's an expert on many, many of the subjects we discuss on this program. He's an attorney. And he's also one of the nation's leading experts on scams and fraud. As a matter of fact, he's written the Bible on the subject, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. And also his recent book is titled Identity Theft Alert, also published by Prentice Hall. His website, scamicide.com, is one of the leading sources of information about fraud and scams. Here now is Steve Wiseman to discuss income tax identity theft. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, we're well into the income tax filing season, and frankly, the earlier you file, the better off you are as far as protecting yourself from the scourge of income tax identity theft. The IRS paid out $5 billion last year, that's billion with a B, in fraudulent returns when these income tax identity thieves steal your name and social security number and dummy up a return, file it electronically, and get your refund. And you try and file your legitimate return, and it can take you anywhere from 6 months or more to get a return. You know, just recently, Intuit, which is the maker of TurboTax, temporarily suspended the use of its state income tax filing software due to what the company referred to as, quote, an increase in suspicious filings, unquote. But after a few days, the company restored the usability of this software. The issue came to a head when the Minnesota Department of Revenue said it would no longer accept online tax filings using TurboTax because of problems with income tax identity theft. The problem, however, is not with TurboTax, but rather with the entire system for filing state and federal income taxes online. Once they've stolen someone's Social Security number, identity thieves are finding it pretty easy to file a phony income tax return using the Social Security number of the person whose identity they've stolen, along with phony W-2 figures claiming substantial refund. And since neither the states nor the IRS compare the W-2 figures contained in tax returns with those filed by employers before sending out a refund, income tax identity theft is a low-risk, high-reward criminal enterprise. And the thing is, a lot of you may be using TurboTax, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with the TurboTax software. However, what's happening now is a lot of these identity thieves and scammers are sending out emails, because we know that there's been a problem with TurboTax, saying that there's been a problem with your filing and they need to confirm information, and they ask you for information. Don't give it. trust me, you can't trust anyone. Whenever you get an email or a text message asking you to click on a link or to provide personal information, never, ever do it until you've confirmed that it is indeed legitimate.
Thank you, Steve. Steve Wiseman joins us every week here on A Touch of Gray. He's a senior correspondent on the show. He's also a prolific writer, a lawyer, and an expert on scams and fraud, as well as many of the topics we talk about. He's written Identity Theft Alert and The Truth About Avoiding Scams, both published by Prentice Hall, and his website. Check it out. It's very, very valuable. It's scamaside.com. Steve Wiseman. I'm Michael Harrison, and I want to thank Beverly Santinello on the front line, our producer, putting it all together, Kevin Casey from Talkers Magazine for sharing some insights about the media, and of course, Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues, and a champion in the battle against ageism. And remember, no matter how many years you have, you know, on your odometer, no matter how many times you've taken that voyage around the sun, it's never too late to follow your dreams, to follow your passions, and to really enjoy your life to its fullest. Never too late at all. So get cracking at it. I'm Michael Harrison. Thank you for joining us. Join us again next weekend right here on A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups.